Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Rest of History bonus. Hello, Dominic. Hope you had a good Christmas. Hope everyone listening had a good Christmas.
Oh, wonderful, Tom.
Did you?
Yeah, brilliant.
We've slightly given the game away, haven't we, in the previous bonus, where we said that we were actually recording these before Christmas.
No, but that's not true. But you were tricking people. We're actually recording this on Christmas Day, aren't we, Tom? How's it going?
That's good.
Have you opened your presents?
Yeah, we're cooking the goose, all that kind of thing.
That's nice. I've just been to church, actually.
Have you?
Oh. And we're coming back and we're watching Morecambe and Wise Christmas special. Because I like to pretend we're in 1974.
Oh, right. So you're not researching for the next bonus episode, which is what I'll be doing.
Oh, right. Very good. Very good. Yeah, I'll probably be doing that later and on Boxing Day.
So the listeners can tell who cares more about them.
Yeah. So where are we in the run? Last week, if you remember, we had Victorian Britain's Maddest Mystery. That was fun, wasn't it?
Yep. And the Windrush episode.
Oh, such fun.
And on Christmas Day, we had, or we will have had, I'm getting so confused what time zone we're in.
Yeah.
Me talking about whether basically Christmas was piggybacking on earlier festivals, particularly the Saturnalia.
Right. Yes.
And coming up, we have the pregnant Pope.
Yeah. Female popes. Very exciting.
So that's out tomorrow.
And next week, we always like to start the new year, Tom, with a really jolly light subject,
yes,
don't we?
We do.
And so would you like to share with the listeners what we're doing next week?
So we have a 6-part series on the Nazis in power. However,
yeah,
Dominic's raising his hand because there are complications here. So it is a 6-part series, but we have only had time before Christmas to record 4 of them. So you will be getting 4 episodes on 1st of January.
Yeah.
And I really apologize. We just haven't had time to do the last 2 episodes, which we will be doing when we come back from our holidays. So I think in a way,
yeah,
this is a good thing because it will stop
binging.
Those of you who like to binge and then have nothing to listen to for 3 weeks.
There's been a lot of binging.
So really it's for the listener's own good, isn't it, Dominic?
Yeah, it is. And actually you say 2 more episodes, but there's part of me that wonders whether it'll actually be 3.
Yeah. So the episodes are, we've got one on the Night of the Long Knives.
Yeah.
And then we have one on the Nuremberg Rally and the Triumph of the Will.
Yeah.
Then we have 2 on the Gathering of the Storm Clouds of War.
We do, yeah.
So we've got the making of the Nazi war machine, the Nazi economy, autobahns.
Yeah. We say autobahns, Tom. We mentioned autobahns for about 42 seconds.
And then going up to the Anschluss.
Yeah, Austria.
And the Anschluss features an excellent bit of singing from me.
I've actually forgotten what that was. What was that?
Well, again,
I have to listen to find out.
You'll be pleasantly surprised. It's from probably the most celebrated fictional account of the Anschluss in the English-speaking world.
Right.
And then,
yeah,
and this, I think, explains why we didn't want to rush the last 2 or possibly 3 episodes. We are going to be looking at what happened to the Jews under the Nazis and to try and not just recount the process by which basically the Nazis in the 30s were kind of gearing up to the horrors that overwhelmed the Jews in the war, but also to try and kind of do a deep dive into what their ideological justifications were.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it's not a cheery subject, but it's obviously a very important one. And we want to do it
justice,
as much justice as we possibly can.
Yeah.
So that's why we haven't kind of rushed it.
No.
Anyway, so those are to come.
Yeah. All that's to come.
We hope that you will forgive us for the slight staggered nature of the episodes that you'll be getting.
Yeah. And then after that, we're going backwards in time, aren't we? To the Man in the Iron Mask and Peasants Revolt and things like that. So all that to look forward to. Now, Tom.
It's New Year. So New Year is coming up. So the year is dying.
Oh, yeah. You wanted to have some rambling chat, didn't you?
I thought some rambling chat would be good. I mean, it's traditional, isn't it? At this time of year.
Okay. Yeah, sure.
2023, a historic year or not?
Well, all years are historic, Tom, but is it a year that will live in...
That will be remembered?
No. I'd say no, not really. What would it be remembered for?
I don't think it would be remembered for much.
Oh.
Because I think everything that's happened.
Yeah.
So whether it's Ukraine.
Yeah.
Or whether it's Israel and Gaza.
Yeah.
Or whether it's climate change conferences.
Yeah.
Or whether it's economic stasis. It's simply more of the same, isn't it?
Yeah, I think so.
It's people kind of running to stand still. It's people running up a down escalator. It's Wile E. Coyote having run off a cliff and his legs going round and round.
Right.
The sense that nothing really is changing and a lot of energy is being spent on keeping everyone in the same place. So it's pretty depressing.
I guess if you're Israeli, for example, then it would be remembered always for the events of October, the Hamas attack. Similarly, if you're Palestinian, for the war in Gaza. But if you're outside those places, I don't think those are conflicts that will, you know, I would say there are very few sort of, as it were, overseas conflicts that end up with a long lasting place in, let's say, for example, the British imagination. Well, if you ask people in Britain, what do you remember from the last 20 years? They'd remember September the 11th, 2001. They'd remember the invasion of Iraq. I suppose they might remember the Russian invasion of Ukraine.
The crash, 2008.
The financial crash. But then it would all be domestic politics.
But I think the thing about Israel and Gaza, I mean, I agree, these are seismic events that will be remembered and recorded and studied in histories of Israel and Palestine.
Mm.
But it's not reconfiguring it, it doesn't seem.
No.
I mean, it's just a repetition of a kind of ongoing nightmare.
Yeah.
And it, you know, it joins dates like,
yeah,
you know, the 6 Days War or the invasion of Lebanon or whatever. It's definitely a punctuation mark, but it's not a seismic reordering of things. Whereas Russia's invasion of Ukraine, I think that was a dramatic rupture, but nothing has happened this year that really reconfigures.
No, agreed.
The impact of what happened in the previous year.
No, because it's turned into World War One, actually, the First World War, hasn't it? The Russian-Ukrainian War.
Yeah.
And I think in British politics and in American politics, it's a continuation, as you said, of the existing narrative, isn't it? So anywhere they've had elections. So Australia, Tom, they had a very contentious referendum in 2023, just before we went, and you were very anxious that we would be sucked into it, into the more of the referendum debate.
I just felt that two Englishmen turning up after an incredibly raw and sensitive result for lots of Australians.
Yeah.
That it would have been like two Australians turning up a week after Brexit and opining about that. I just didn't feel that we were qualified, really.
Yeah. Unbelievable. So lily livered. So since it's the end of the year, Tom, I knew you wanted to do a little bit of a roundup. So what's your favorite book you've read this year? History book.
Favorite history book was, well, I nominated it for the Goalhanger newsletter. So people will have seen that.
God, a coveted award that is.
Coveted award. So it was by Mark Gregory Pegg, and it was a history of the Middle Ages.
Yeah.
One of my favorite books of medieval history is Peter Brown's.
Oh, yeah.
Making of Western Christendom, I think it's called. Anyway, but basically it takes the story up to about the year 1000.
Yeah.
And Mark Gregory Pegg, it's very much the same technique. It's zooming in, looking at particular episodes, particular characters, particular moments. So they're kind of like pearls on a necklace, Dominic.
Oh, lovely image.
And so the whole suite gives you a sense of kind of the totality of the sweep of medieval history. But it's really, really good. And people who listened to our episodes on the Cathars may remember that Mark Pegg wrote the book on kind of questioning whether the Cathars existed. It's one of the great books.
Oh, yeah.
And this, I think,
yeah,
is absolutely in that line.
Oh.
And it's wonderfully written. So I highly recommend it.
Nice. So my one.
You did one about the Holocaust, wasn't it?
Yeah, although that makes it sound grimmer than it is. So it's a book called Time's Echo, The Second World War, The Holocaust, and the Music of Remembrance by Jeremy Eichler. Jeremy Eichler is an American classical music critic, I think for the Boston Globe. And so this is a book where he basically looks at the lives of four composers, and they are Richard Strauss, Arnold Schoenberg, Benjamin Britten, and Dmitri Shostakovich. And he basically traces their lives through the Second World War and the way in which they and their music kind of responded to the war, but also the Holocaust.
Oh, that does sound good.
Because he's not a historian, he's a music critic. There's a lot, obviously, about the music, but he makes it really accessible to people like me who don't read music or, you know, I love classical music, but I don't really understand it, as it were.
Just like the noise.
Yeah, I like the noise. Exactly. I like the noise. But it's a brilliant book. He really gets under the skin of the four individuals. I mean, he says that he's trying to write in the tradition of W.G. Sebald, the German writer.
Great walker.
Yeah, great walker and a great writer, actually, also about the sort of the memory of war and guilt and trauma and things like that. So what Sebald often wrote about was place, was the way in which places kind of carry meaning and memory.
Because he lived in Britain, didn't he, and walked the East Anglian coastline, yeah, and things.
Yes, exactly. And Eichler writes really well about places, about camps. He writes about Coventry particularly. So I know, Tom, you love Coventry. There are some really, really good sections about Coventry Cathedral.
Is that in the Britain?
Yes, about Benjamin Britten and his war requiem at Coventry Cathedral. So I read that book. It ended up winning lots of awards. It was shortlisted for the Bailey Gifford Award, which is the biggest British nonfiction award. And it's one of those things, I don't know whether you ever have this. So I read that book. I was probably one of the first people in Britain to read it because I was reviewing it for the Sunday Times. I really loved it. I made a great fuss one of my rare hullabaloos at the Sunday Times and said, instead of writing 500 words about it, I wanted to write 1,000, and I wanted it to be a big piece, because I said, it's a really, really good book. You know, you won't regret it. Please let me write more about it and all this. And then because of that, when you've sort of championed a book, then you end up becoming a kind of fan of it.
Yeah, of course.
So you end up kind of looking for reviews and yes, it got a good review, because it slightly vindicates your own judgment.
It's like a kind of manager buying a player, a star player.
Exactly. That's exactly it.
Yeah.
You've spent some of your capital on this book. So the book went on to do really well and I was delighted. But it's actually just a really, really good book because it's such a well-worn subject.
I'll read it.
It's a really well-worn subject, but he does it really well. You could know nothing at all about music and you will find the book great, because it's about the four lives of the people. You know, one of them is British, one of them is German, one of them is Austrian, and one of them is Russian. And so it explores all kinds of different things. So yeah, it's a really, really good book.
Yeah. Okay. Well, so one of the things I'm looking forward to next year is, because I won't be doing a book or promoting one, I'm hoping I'll have more time, because basically this year I've read a lot of history books, but they've all been part of the podcast, basically.
Yeah.
I mean, when I look back, I mean,
yeah,
how much we've read.
I know. It's terrifying.
Over the course of this year. But it's kind of difficult to find the time to read anything that doesn't relate directly to something you're either doing a podcast about or perhaps reviewing or something like that.
Should I tell you another book that I read in the last couple of months? It's about 10 years old, which I couldn't believe how good a book it was. I imagine you'll be reading this quite soon, Tom. Titanic Lives by Richard Davenport Hines.
I have read it.
It's so good. Do you think it was good?
Yes. And he also wrote a brilliant book on the Gothic. He has a very, very eclectic array of subjects.
Yeah. His book on the Titanic, unbelievable.
So in the new year, I'm going to Belfast and I'm staying in the Titanic Hotel.
Are you?
Yeah, it's the converted headquarters of the company that made the Titanic. And you look out and you see the museum.
What could possibly go wrong, Tom?
Yeah. Well, no icebergs in Northern Ireland.
No.
We've got that to come, haven't we? A couple of episodes on the Titanic.
Yeah. Oh, I mean, he does this stuff where I'm comparing it with a book called A Night to Remember. There's a book called A Night to Remember by Walter Lord.
The 30s, was that written?
Yeah, it's written in the 50s.
50s.
Because I have to write an introduction of that for a fancy new edition. And the difference between those two books is off the scale.
Yeah.
A Night to Remember, he just talks about the Astors and the sort of fancy people. And then he throws in one or two people from Steerage to make you feel kind of sentimental. So it's very kind of like James Cameron's film. But Richard Davenport Hines is, he says, there are also 50 people from the Lebanon or whatever. He's found lots of stuff about their village. He's found all this stuff about these people from Croatia who are on the ship and all that. And it's a brilliant, it ends up being a social history of Europe and the Mediterranean world and the United States.
Yeah. And that's the great value of the Titanic, isn't it? As a metaphor.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Huge metaphor hits iceberg.
Yes. Yeah. Very good.
Can't remember what that was in.
Yeah. Very good. Is that The Onion or something like that?
Yeah. Something like that. Yeah. I am currently reading, pretty much for the first time, I'm reading a history book that has nothing to do with anything that we're going to be doing a podcast on. And it's by a friend of the show, Francis Young, who came on and talked about the occult.
Oh, yeah.
And it's a rather similar theme. And it's called Twilight of the Godlings, The Shadowy Beginnings of Britain's Supernatural Beings. And basically, it's where do elves come from?
Interesting.
So the stuff that Tolkien, the elves, the dwarves, these kind of shadowy figures who are manifest throughout medieval culture, and particularly late medieval culture. Mm. And of course, then into, you know, they appear in Shakespeare and right the way through into the 20th century. Where do they come from? And it's actually fascinating, really fascinating.
And Tom, what's your favorite thing you've been to see this year? So it could be a play, an exhibition.
Oh, God.
Were there any things that stand out in your mind?
Can you nominate yours? Because you've obviously prepared.
Okay. So I went to see Akhenaten, Philip Glass opera.
Yes.
That was brilliant. I would put that up there. This weekend, I saw two plays, both of which I commend to the listeners. So one of them, which you probably won't be able to get tickets for, was David Tennant as Macbeth.
I looked and I haven't been able to.
He was brilliant.
The witches don't appear in the opening scenes. It's all done through headphones.
You wear headphones. It's really, really well done. He and Cush Jumbo, who is Lady Macbeth, who is a very good actress, they're a brilliant pair. I mean, David Tennant is probably, for my money, it's, I think, the fourth time maybe I've seen him do Shakespeare on stage. And I think he speaks the verse as well as anybody. as well as anybody alive. I think he's a brilliant, brilliant actor.
It's Silent of the Donmar, isn't it?
Yeah.
Did you see it there?
Yeah, it's a very, very small space. So there's not many of you in there. There's about 200 people, maybe. So it's incredibly intimate, very claustrophobic staging. You're wearing these headphones, so they are whispering some of the lines into your ears, and it feels incredibly intimate.
That's a great idea.
So it's a really, really good idea.
God, imagine being the director who came up with that.
Yeah, it's a really good idea.
That's a brilliant idea. I have very fond memories of the Donmar.
Yeah.
Because it was 2 days before Katie, our first daughter, was born.
Yeah.
We went there to see Into the Woods, the Sondheim musical.
Oh, yeah.
And we adored it with all the kind of passionate intensity of two people who are about not to see anything.
Yeah, of course.
For about 4 or 5 years.
Yeah.
So it was very much, you know, condemned man's last meal.
Yeah.
That's very unfair on Katie. And if she's listening to this, I apologize to her.
Oh, poor Katie.
But parents will know what I mean.
The person who deprived you of playgoing for 4 or 5 years. So the other thing I saw this weekend, which is still running and which is brilliant, it's friend of the show, Agatha Christie's Witness for the Prosecution, which they do in the old council chamber of the GLC, the Greater London Council. So it's in County Hall. Have you seen that, Tom?
No, I haven't.
It's in County Hall. It is fantastic. The setting.
Is it?
Because they do it in the council chamber and it's a courtroom. It's a courtroom drama.
Oh.
And you can buy tickets that put you in the jury. So you're in the jury and the jury have to do things. Stand up and sit down and then pronounce the verdict at the end of the play. It was brilliant.
What's it called? Witness for the Prosecution.
Yeah. It's a tremendous laugh.
I might try and go and see that.
It's really good fun. It's Agatha Christie at her best. Lots of twists. They made a film of it in the 50s, which was very successful.
So I saw a play that I think probably isn't a classic, but slipped down very, very easily,
yeah.
Which was Backstairs Billy.
What's Backstairs Billy?
Backstairs Billy was the chief footman who waited on the Queen Mother.
Right. Is that his name?
That was how he was known. Yeah. I think you'd moderately enjoy it.
Why on earth did you go to see that, Tom?
My sister-in-law, Rachel, bought tickets.
Right.
She had Penelope Wilton.
Penelope Wilton from Ever Decreasing yeah. Circles.
From Ever Decreasing Circles.
Love Penelope Wilton.
Yeah. She's the Queen Mother.
Right. Yeah. Oh, very good.
I think the best thing I saw, and I haven't been to much again because I've been kind of flat out reading books, Dominic.
Right. Oh, poor you, Tom. What a martyr.
I saw Marriage of Figaro at Covent Garden. Have you seen that production?
No, I'm not.
It's brilliant. The whole thing is designed to look like late 18th century lithographs.
Oh, that's clever. Yeah. Yeah.
So, you know, those kind of illustrations of Marie Antoinette on the garden or something like that.
Yeah.
In a kind of faded brown.
Yeah.
It was beautiful. You know, there wasn't a moment where it didn't just look beautiful. And, you know, it sounded beautiful. It had amazing singers.
Oh, that sounds fantastic. That sounds absolutely fantastic.
That was the thing that stuck in my mind.
Okay.
Anyway, listen, we've rabbited on.
Let's do a couple of questions because there's a question I want to answer. I know you don't like JFK questions, but I like this one. So I'm going to answer it. It's from Peter Sarkis. And he says, are there any 20th century US or European political assassinations where a conspiracy theory is the most likely explanation? Or at least plausible. Now, Tom, do you know what I'm going to say?
No.
I'm going to say yes, and we're going to be doing it next year. And it's a conspiracy theory, which did happen. It is plausible, and it's the most consequential conspiracy theory in 20th century history.
Oh, Sarajevo.
Sarajevo.
Yeah.
So, 1914, Franz Ferdinand is shot in broad daylight by Gavrilo Princip. It is a conspiracy. It's a conspiracy that has long been planned and has been aided and abetted by elements that are either within or very close to Serbian intelligence. And the existence of that conspiracy triggers the First World War because the Austrians think, in the face of this conspiracy, we cannot just do nothing. And it's interesting, had the Lee Harvey Oswald, you know, had it been a conspiracy in which, for example, the Cuban government had been involved,
yeah.
Would we talk of this
yeah.
as the moment that led to the Third World War, because the Americans had to respond, as the Austrians, I think, probably had to respond to the conspiracy in 1914. So that's a really consequential conspiracy.
Yeah.
It's not that I don't think conspiracies exist. They do exist. But I don't think shadowy conspiracies that are somehow undetected by the authorities but visible to keyboard warriors, I don't think they exist.
What about Princess Diana? Let's throw that out.
Yeah, Princess Diana. Very good.
Anyway, on that bombshell, have a very happy new year.
Yes.
And we will see you in the new year.
Yeah. We're so excited about that, aren't we? We've got so many cool things to come in the new year, Tom. Cool things. I can't believe I just said that.
Hey.
Yeah.
Cool things.
We'll be adopting much more youth-friendly lingo as well in the new year. So that's all to look forward to.
Well, we are very much a youth-oriented podcast.
We are. Yeah. 50% of our listeners are under the age of 35.
So we are going to make an effort to start
talking to them in language they understand.
Talking to them in language they understand.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
All right.
So you will have the Nazis next week, and what a treat that will be. And on that bombshell, happy new year.
Happy new year.